Okay, well, welcome. I'm Jim McLaughlin. I teach philosophy and religion at Western Carolina University, but I grew up in Utah, and so I'm a Mormon. and today we've got a nice panel here to discuss a book that's being edited by David Polson and Don Musser on Mormonism in dialogue with Christian theology. Starting on my extreme right, we have Richard Sherlock, who participated in the dialogue on Reinhold Niebuhr. Then Joe Price, who did Paul Tillich. Joe is from Whittier College. He did the article on Tillich and his Mormon respondent, I'll have to explain all this, was Truman Madsen. Then we have Warner Woodward here, who did the response to Mahaffey Brown on liberation theology. Warner is a professor at Brigham Young University. I think you all know that Richard is a professor at Utah State University. I forgot to say that. What we're going to do is we're going to take about 15 minutes. You can run off over a little if you want to. Philosophers and theologians are long-winded people. A little. to talk about our experience with the book, the experience with our respondents or the person we're responding to, and why we think the text is important, particularly our own particular, I guess, contributions or subjects. Perhaps. What I'm going to do is just explain what the volume was first, and then I'll talk a little bit. I've got a letter here from David Polson that I'm going to read about the history of the volume. But basically what the volume is David Polson was able to put together some really quality Christian theologians. He was able to bring them to Brigham Young, where they did many seminars. And then he asked several Mormon scholars to respond to the theological positions offered by those people. Then the person who gave the seminar responded to the Mormon response, and then the Mormon responder responded to the response of the responder. Okay? You got the idea? Anyway, it took a while to put this book together. Maybe in the conversation we'll talk about why. But let me just read a letter from David describing the history of the thing. Here's a rough sketch of how the project emerged. From 1994 through 1998, I served as Richard L. Evans Professor of Religious Understanding. The Richard L. Evans Chair was created in 1972 at the instance and by means of an endowment of Lowell Berry, a California industrialist. Lowell was a Presbyterian and a dear friend of the late LDS apostle and voice of the spoken word, Richard L. Evans. The chair was created for the purpose of promoting dialogue, friendship, mutual understanding and respect between Latter-day Saints and those of other religious faiths. Truman Madsen was the first holder of the chair and held the chair from 1972 to 1994. At that time, the chair overseers decided to change the chair from a career appointment to a 2 to 4 year professorship. I was appointed as Evans Professor in 1994. When I was appointed to the professorship, I was encouraged to bring conversation partners to BYU, being advised that if I had presented papers at conferences elsewhere, I would bring with me a candle, but if I brought non-LDS to BYU, I would bring them to a blaze. In accord with this counsel, I decided to invite a number of non-member scholars to come to BYU and present many seminars on contemporary Christian theologies. Pursuant to this end, I consulted with Martin Marty, renowned professor of Christian theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School. He actually has written the preface to the book. He suggested I contact Donald Musser, University of Chicago Divinity School PhD and professor of theology at Stetson University, along with Joe Price, we have here. They had recently published two works, The Handbook of Christian Theology and The Handbook of Christian Theologians. Don enthusiastically agreed to be my partner and a collaborator on the project. He suggested both the topics and the presenters for the mini-seminars and helped me nail down presenter commitments to participate. Several of the presenters were fellow University of Chicago Divinity School alums, and I believe they were nearly all friends of Don. Don also kicked off the mini-seminars with a series of lectures introducing Christian theology given under the title Mapping the Ferment. At the time, I had no plan for a book. Dennis McCann, who Richard responded to, who did the mini-seminar on Niebuhr, suggested both the book and its format, consisting of dialogue on each theologian between the original presenter and a Mormon respondent. Once we decided to go with this format, we were invited the chosen Mormon respondent to participate in the relevant mini-seminar, but most dialogues ensued by mail exchanges rather than person-to-person encounters. I was pleasantly surprised to find a number of LDS respondents who were already knowledgeable on a given Christian theological movement. For instance, Roger Keller wrote his dissertation on Karl Barth. Truman Madsen studied under and wrote his dissertation on Paul Tillich. Richard Sherlock on Reinhold Niebuhr. Jim McLaughlin had studied process thought at Claremont with David Griven. That's not correct, but I'll explain that. Ditto for Jean England on black theology. Camille Williams on Christian feminism. Jim Faulkner on theology as hermeneutics. And so the dialogue conversations were launched. Let me, before I launch into just what I'm going to say, a few minutes about process theology, my part of the book, I want to read to you some of the blurbs that are supposedly coming out on this. This is from Validly Ziegler at DePauw University. She writes, this is pretty cool, I'm just taking this out of the context of what part of her letter. He says, and whoa, Camille Williams versus Rosemary Radford Ruther was fairly amazing. Okay. People who know mainline, this is just a note, then I'll read her blurb. People who know mainline theology may skip rapidly through some of those chapters, but given the hope for a dual audience, I see why the long discussions of Barth, Tillich, and Pals were necessary. The Mormon readings I found fascinating. This book is important and deserves a wide audience. Now, here's our blurb for the book. Most of us who do scholarly work in Christian thought and history know next to nothing about Mormon theology. This book, Joe can bear that out for us, this book offers a rare opportunity to encounter dialogues between LDS authors and scholars of mainline Christianity on topics ranging from gender, race, liberation, and myth to neo-orthodoxy. Tillich hermeneutics, process, cosmology. Tantalizing affinities between Mormon and the mainline emerge, as do distinct disjunctions. These reflections are certain to inform and challenge readers on both sides of the discussion as well as, one can hope, to provide a foundation for future conversations. This is a groundbreaking work. Here's one from Bishop John Shelby Spong. Those of you on the left know who he is. Okay. Every year I participate in a group called the Highlands Institute for American Philosophy and Theology in Highlands, North Carolina, just up the road from where I teach. And we had Bishop Spong up one year, and it was amazing how many protesters we had. Okay. It's also amazing how many people showed up for this, because usually when we have a speaker in, you know, maybe 30 people show up. You know, I couldn't even get into a room to see him on TV. Okay, but anyway, this is what he says about the book. Don Musser and David Paulson in this book have created a volume that forces dialogue between mainstream Christianity and the Mormon or Latter-day Saint Commission tradition. Every effort that replaces misconceptions with truth is a step to a deeper and fuller humanity. I commend this effort. Here's one from Terrell Givens. This is an exhilarating and enlightening read, which performs two essential services. It introduces and surveys some of the best work being done across the contemporary theological spectrum, and it draws Mormons and Mormon thought into those conversations in illuminating ways. It is an invaluable contribution that truly advances the best kind of interreligious dialogue. And finally, one from Robert Millen. Too often, Latter-day Saint thinkers have not been part of major religious conversations. That's true. This book is a welcome opportunity for our outstanding LDS minds, these guys anyway, to engage in some of the leading thinkers and movements in religious studies. Readers of all sides will be stimulated and informed as they see familiar theological terrain in new lights, as traditional and Mormon scholars deal rigorously with important ideas with the distinguished proponents of those ideas. Great topics, a good read, I strongly recommend it. Okay, so, go out and buy the book when it comes out. Let me tell you a little bit about my participation with David Griffin from Claremont Graduate University, Claremont School of Theology. David is has his facts wrong in here when he says that I had studied with Griffin. I did study with Griffin, but only after I'd written my essay. I did my graduate work at the University of Toronto, where I worked mainly in continental philosophy, existentialism, and something called personalism, which is an American school of philosophy which nobody knows about anymore. But Martin Luther King was a personalist, and so was William H. Chamberlain, the very first Mormon to actually study philosophy. Emphasize, personalism is the type of philosophy closest to Mormons, and you guys should all realize it. Okay. Anyway, I'd done some process theology at Toronto and at Indiana University when I was there, and David made the horrendous mistake of asking me to respond to David Griffin instead of Dan Wotherspoon, who had actually been one of Griffin's students. David is those of you who know David Paulson, David Paulson is a prince of a human being. He's a really good scholar, but we're all human. One of the great things about my doing what I did was I had never met Dan. I'd never heard about Dan. Somebody told me about Dan, and I emailed Dan, and Dan sent me his dissertation, which was enormously helpful getting me back into process theology. But I wasn't going to relinquish my chance. Started writing it. I went to a Whitehead conference that Griffin put on at Claremont. We talked. I wrote my paper. He responded to my paper, which was a response to his paper at BYU. He responded to my paper. I responded back to him. Then my wife, Carrie, who's back there, decided she wanted, it was her turn to get a PhD. This was just serendipity. She went to study Native American history at the University of California at Riverside, which was 20 miles from Claremont, where David Griffin teaches. And so I went out there on a sabbatical because I didn't want a two-year-long distance marriage. And I was appointed as a visiting scholar at the Center for Crop Process Studies and spent a year studying with David Griffin and Marjorie Suhaki and John Cobb doing process theology. And I'm really glad I did, because it really got me back into something that I'm very interested in. And hopefully Dan and I are working on a book together on process theology and Mormonism, which will come out. So I got great things out of this. I got to know Dan, and I got to know David Griffin and process people. Okay, that's my history in this, and I'm going to just take about 5 minutes and talk about the importance of our David Griffin and my particular section in the volume. Some of you may know stuff about things about process theology. I know Randy and Brian do. Brian's a graduate of Claremont, and was converted away from the truth by T.C. Phillips. Lured away from the truth is what I should say, I guess. And if you don't believe that, you can just meet David Griffin. What I found particularly important in our particular discussion is process theology of the theological positions that are out there, with the staggering exceptions of certain forms of German idealism and personalism is, I think, the closest philosophical and theological position to what Mormons are doing. Sterling McMurrin used to talk like this. The reason is that we have a God who's in process, who is learning things from the world, who is in relation to the world. We have a notion that talks about relation as the single most important philosophical category. We have a philosophical and theological position who says that creativity is the ultimate, you know, which for Mormons, if you look at the idea of intelligence, you have something really to talk about with these people. So talking with David was a delight. There have been several Mormons who have gone to Claremont and done process theology, at least recently a few more. So process theology offers a lot for Mormons to think about, a lot of grist to think about. Of course, like any theological position, and this is where I have an argument with Sterling McMurrin, who was a man I admired greatly, and I think was one of the sweetest human beings I've ever met, but he wrote a book called, that you all know about, I'm sure, Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion. I'm sorry, I've got to tell one little story here. When I was on my mission, well, before that, I grew up in a weird house, fairly conservative Mormons, but who read things, and I grew up thinking that T. Edgar Lyon, Lowell Bunyan, and Sterling McMurrin were general authorities. And with that kind of weird understanding of the world, when I came home from my mission, I went to interview with my BYU bishop, and he asked me, what kind of gospel reading are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm reading Sterling McMurrin's Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, which my bishop's eyes opened up, you know, huge, and what? So anyway, but there's a problem there. When McMurrin says there are theological foundations to a religion, one way to understand that is that what the stories, the myths, all those things are at the base are really just kind of veneer over what's, you know, really under there. This is a kind of modernist approach. Religions, though, you know, if you do comparative religion, my degree's in religious studies. Religions are a lot more diverse than that. And there are a whole lot of theological positions you can take within a religion. All you have to do is look at the history of the things. Hinduism. There are six major philosophical schools that try and explain Hinduism. Traditional ones. There are more than that. And, you know, so when Mormons, I would hate to see Mormonism become process theology is what I'm saying here, because it's more than that. There are some things in Mormonism that actually conflict with process theology. I would argue that relations between human beings, or at least, and their effect on each other in Mormonism, are at least as important, perhaps more important than their effect and relationship with God. I would also argue that since Mormons have this idea that God was once a human being, we can never say that God was, as process theology does, metaphysically, morally perfect. You know, God had to decide to be morally perfect. If there were temptations, you know, if you read Brothers Karamazov, you know, this is one of the things the Grand Inquisitor says. Sure, a God can turn down food, power, and glory. Name a human being that can. You know, Jesus had to really think, yeah, man, I'm hungry. I would really like to set things straight by my power. And he had to turn it down. But anyway, conclusion, I've probably taken too long. You should read Process Theology and you should buy the book. Thanks.
Well, Jim knows I don't agree with any of that process theology stuff. And I don't think Mormonism is some of that, though I do think there are important similarities. But there's one similarity between, there's one huge similarity between Reinhold Niebuhr and Mormonism. Mormonism, well, it's a similarity and a dissimilarity. Mormonism has elements from which one could construct a robust theology. But we haven't done it. Reinhold Niebuhr didn't have a theology. And there's nothing in his thought from which you could construct one. He was fundamentally, his way into Christian theology, if you want to call it that in a kind of loose sense, is through the lived experience of being a pastor in a small, struggling, poor church in Detroit in the 1920s, coming out of that and teaching ethics at Union Theological Seminary. He fundamentally had a moral animus, a moral drive, to which he then attached those kind of theological sentiments. That really worked out theology. Attached a series of moral sentiments that, in his mind, seemed to go with it. He was not a theologian like his brother at Yale. He was a moralist and attached whatever theology he needed to make that work. But he had an enormous impact on Christian thought in America in the 20th century. Some of it, it's all important. Some of it, I think, very significant and very, I don't say appealing, but, and I don't want to say true. Well, you could say true, but Niebuhr didn't have a theory of truth. He thought that metaphysics was not part of his enterprise, which I think is wrong. But Niebuhr there are parts of Niebuhr that are very important and significant for Mormons that we need to be part of that discussion. We need to appropriate Niebuhr. He has many important things to say to us. Some of the things he's most noted for, personally, I think he's dead wrong on, but that's another question. Maybe Niebuhr's most famous and important essay he ever wrote is from 1940. Why the Christian Church is Not Pacifist. Since I've been a pacifist for my whole adult life, I think Niebuhr's just wrong about that. But it is the essay you have to contend with if you are a pacifist. That is the essay you have to contend with. So what did Niebuhr bring to the table that we need to appropriate with? Mormonism started out with with the hope, the expectation, the drive to build a city of God on earth, a temporal Zion, to collapse the distinction in Christian thought, at least since Augustine, between the city of God and the city of man. That the city of God would be here, right, somewhere on earth. To collapse that distinction. We found out through long struggle that there were two things wrong with that aspiration. Which, if we had read R. Augustine, we would have known from the beginning. First, was that human nature is not such that that can be done. That human nature, we have diverse desires, preferences, longings, attachments. And that a stable community has to find a way to bring those together. Madison, Federalist 10. You can't stamp out differences. They are going to be there. You have to find a way to let them out in such a way that they don't destroy the hole you're trying to build. Joseph Smith tried to construct a political order in a way that is simply not possible. You can't have a stable political order or the rule of law if the leader of the community, Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, can turn around tomorrow and say, sorry, the way we've been doing it is wrong because God wants it done a completely different way. You just can't. Revelation is the core of Mormonism. Of that I have no doubt. But you can't build a political order unless you find a way to contain Revelation. Unless you find a way to limit its scope. So, the first thing, or one of the first things, that Brigham Young did when he came to the Salt Lake Valley was set up a constitution for the state of Deseret that is modeled after the American Constitution. To be sure, Mormons dominated. But if you go to, you know, Tupelo, Mississippi, and you aren't a fundamentalist, your soul is in danger. So the idea that Mormonism is somehow unique but is not right. But the first thing Brigham Young did was set up a political order that a territorial legislature, a territorial governor, a territorial judiciary, which was a way of saying human nature has to be accommodated for now. Now, partly that is because I think early Mormonism, like early Christianity, and for early Mormonism, read Grant Underwood's fabulous book. Early Mormonism, in 1831, if there was a gathering of saints, they actually believed that Jesus could come again in 10 seconds, and it would all be over. So why worry about building a stable political order if you think that it's going to happen, you know, in 10 seconds, you know? That you could just be standing here talking to your friends and Jesus could come right down. Brigham Young realized that was not happening. So we needed to. So the first thing you have to do is accommodate human nature. The second thing you have to do is accommodate history. Now that doesn't mean that you collapse theology into history. It doesn't mean that we should cheer when the great French thinker Pierre Manon in the City of Man says, or City and Man, says, today we are all, it's all history. There isn't any metaphysics, there isn't any theology, it's all history. We shouldn't want that, but we should at least accommodate history. Mormonism went through that accommodation in the struggle over plural marriage. That took 2 decades to play itself out. We went through that struggle that sometimes you have to accommodate history in order to have a larger purpose. Supposing Mormonism had been able to maintain plural marriage in the Intermountain West. Supposing political forces or the South had won the Civil War or whatever. We couldn't, if we were like fundamentalist Mormonism, we couldn't be a world church. You might do very well at perfecting the handful of saints that are behind the barricade, but you're not going to send missionaries around the world. And Reinhold Niebuhr's understanding of the difference between the city of God and the city of man, and that Christian perfectionism wasn't possible, the way he resurrected that as a critique against the social gospel, which had a perfectionist strain in it. The way he resurrected what he called Christian realism. It's not what philosophers would call realism, but it was, look, we are in the world, we got to make the best we can with it, and we've got to accommodate the forces of history present. The way that Niebuhr brought that to the fore says much about the way in which Mormons had to make that accommodation. That was, I think, the genius of Reinhold Niebuhr, is that he thought that we had to make an accommodation. That Christianity couldn't be behind the barricades, seeking perfection for a small, elect, special group. It wouldn't work. And if you were going to be out there, you had to make compromises. And hopefully, you wouldn't have to compromise your core. Reinhold Niebuhr could have had, like his brother, a richer, deeper theology to understand what that core was, but at least he understood that we have to make those accommodations. And that, I think, was the important part of Reinhold Niebuhr's thinking for Mormons. My interlocutor, Dennis McCann, was a Chicago student, was a fabulous Niebuhr scholar, and we've kept up a correspondence about Niebuhr. His book on Reinhold Niebuhr and liberation theology was a good book. A Niebuhrian criticism of the utopian aspirations of liberation theology. That you have to tame your aspirations, because human nature and history won't be accommodated as easily as you might think. The publishing history of this volume is much more complicated and bloody than Jim was talking about. If you want to know, ask me, and I will tell you what I'm able to tell you. But I think it is a breakthrough volume. As far as Mormonism in dialogue with other theologies, we now have a fairly robust dialogue with evangelical Protestants. I think we should develop a robust dialogue with Roman Catholics. And I think evangelicals, Mormons, and Roman Catholics are working on some of the same fundamental problems. And I think those dialogues ought to continue.
I have half of the manuscript, actually the PDF of the book from the publisher. So it is coming out next month, be assured. Yes, indeed. One correction that I must make in Richard's very fine sermon that he gave a couple of minutes ago. He made some mention about if the South had won the Civil War. I was taught in Mississippi in the sixth grade that it was the War of Northern Aggression. Technically, a political scientist would say that it was not a civil war, since there was a standing army, a draft, and a currency that were issued, and an elected government. So fun aside, I take delight in having a role reversal in some regard with today's panel. I was one of the original presenters, so now I have been invited to be somewhat of a respondent to an otherwise a respondent's panel. And I feel like I'm really the pinch hitter for the pinch hitter. David Paulson, the architect of the volume, is unable to be with us today. And Donald Musser would have been the logical second choice, having been so instrumental in its shaping. But he also was unable to attend. And since I had participated with both Don and David at earlier stages, I then pinch hit for Don, who would have pinch hit for David. That aside, my familiarity with Mormonism was both beautiful, tainted, and scholarly before entering this project. It was beautiful because my earliest familiarity with Mormonism was with the spoken word and with the broadcasts of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir each Sunday there on WJDX in Jackson, Mississippi. And I could not fathom how something so beautiful might not arouse emotions of sympathy from those in my own congregation where my father was a minister. The tainted part is that when I attended seminary and first began to study Niebuhr and Tillich and Hartshorn and Gustavo Gutierrez, I also was required to take a course in other religions. And in that class, I encountered a very polemical perspective on Mormon history and thought. But as I began to teach, I also began to appreciate the complexity of Mormon history, its oppression in its earliest days, and the incredible work that Lawrence Foster did on the three divergent forms of reading of the Matthean text on Levitical marriage that inform the Oneida community, the Mormons, and the Shakers, each taking different reads of the same text from Matthew. So that was my familiarity with Mormonism when I was invited to participate in the project. I was invited because Don Musser and I had edited the two books, the two handbooks that Marty had recommended that David Paulson consult. And so as Don Musser and I were talking about the shaping of what theologies and theologians to invite to participate, both of us salivated for the opportunity to become involved in the conversation. And it was with that enthusiasm that he and I began to correspond with Dave and to shape then the roster of participants. It was, as the letter from Dave indicated, in conversation with Denny McCann that the idea of a book might be forthcoming from the as the outcome of the project. But what shape should that take with a respondent? In a drive through Heber Valley that Dave took me on during my visit to Provo and to BYU, we discussed how the volume might actually be a dialogue rather than a presentation and a response. And that would come with the possibility of a rejoinder and then a reply so that there would be back and forth on the ideas. That said, that's how the volume took its present shape, and I'm incredibly amazed at the awareness that Dave had of the number of informed respondents who could bring Mormon perspectives to bear on the theologies that were presented in the seminars themselves. And with that said, I've read the responses of each of the other participants today, and they're absolutely incredible. And I learned quite a bit about Mormon thought, which is indeed one of the things that Valerie Ziegler had pointed out. The reading the Mormon responses is fascinating for us non-Mormons. And that brings us to one of the first challenges of the volume. How do we refer to Latter-day Saints and those of a non-restorationist Christian affirmation?
We are the non-restorationists, that's good.
And Don and I kept pushing for the idea that we could be inclusive with non-restorationist Christians. Nonetheless, the language that we finally agreed on that would not be prejudicial would be that Latter-day Saints and Mormons would be acceptable as well as non-Mormon Christians. So I am one of I'm the token non-Mormon Christian from the panel today. my work on Tillich. I cut my theological molars on Tillich. His Dynamics of Faith and Love, Power, and Justice were part of my undergraduate reading that informed how I could enlarge upon a rather restricted understanding of biblical traditions and of Christian experience in a way that moved beyond dogmatic assertions. And with that, I was delighted to be able to write on Tillich, but I made some mistakes in my attempts to establish dialogue because, and I'm quite honored that Truman Madsen, the first holder of the Richard L. Evans Chair, was the person who responded to my essay. He had studied with Tillich at Harvard, something that I was not able to enjoy during my days at Chicago, since Tillich had predeceased my arrival there. Nonetheless, his ethos filled the halls, and so we were able to experience the ground of being, the vacuum, the abyss of it all. And for those who went to Toronto, they would say that Chicago is the abyss. The mistake that I made was that I chose three challenges that I thought that Tillich might make to Mormon thought. And I specify those in my essay, and those three challenges are the method of theology itself, because Tillich understands that it is about correlation, about the questions of existence prompting the reflections on God and on the traditions of faith, rather than dogmatic assertions and the traditions of faith prompting questions. The second was that God, for Tillich, is not a being, not even the most supreme being, but is, in his earliest assertions, being itself. And by the time he completed his third volume of the Systematics, he had virtually acquiesced to Hartshorne and Whitehead and would have thought of it almost as being becoming itself, and talked about spirit much more than being itself, which seemed to have a static character to it. And the third of the points of challenge that I identified were the understanding that of faith itself. Faith is not the assertion of or the acceptance of propositions or statements that might seem to challenge credulity, but instead faith is the state of being ultimately concerned, that which motivates the inner core of our being and our every action is that in which we have faith and that in which we move in faith. And so with those three, I then proceeded to write my contribution, and that prompted Truman to provide a counterpoint to it in a way that was not nearly as embracing for dialogue as the three respondents who are here today. But nonetheless, Truman identifies several specific points of conflict between Tillich and LDS thought and its history. The point that I should have included and did not, as a way of seeking points of convergence rather than points of challenge, and the reason that I need to make one further statement about the points of challenge. The reason I'd chosen those was not only did I perceive that they would challenge Mormon experience and beliefs, they had challenged traditional non-Mormon Christian experience and beliefs in a way that I had found quite liberating. And so in my enthusiasm to share my liberation and my continuing affirmation of being in the Christian tradition. I wanted to be able to share that with the Mormon community at BYU. The point that I left out was Revelation. And for Tillich, much more so than any of the other theologians who are represented in the volume and whose theological positions are represented in the volume, there was an openness to the possibilities of continuing Revelation. For Karl Barth, the final revelation had been in Jesus as the Christ. That's language that Tillich liked to use. Because for Tillich, there was once a question proposed, what would have happened if Jesus had never been born? How would that have affected your theology? And Tillich supposedly replied, not very much. It wouldn't affect it very much. Because of the possibilities of continuing revelation, of the understanding of how reconciliation of humans takes place with being itself as an expression of new being, and that new being is the essence of what he understood Jesus as the Christ to manifest. But with an understanding of the continuing possibilities for revelation, there would have been, I think, greater conversation that could have been produced between Truman and me. And so with that, that's my participation in the book, other than the fact that I've worked closely with Mercer University Press over the years. And so as a co-publisher and then finally a publisher was being sought for the volume, my enthusiastic recommendation of Mark Jolly's work at Mercer University Press as the publisher there, and the friendship that I have with Dave Paulson became a kind of synergy that we've finally been able to issue the volume. So as conclusion, I must make two personal comments that I just love. Dave Paulson is an incredibly genuine, good person. And as he asked me during my BYU visit, what would I like to do? I told him about my fantasy from childhood of being able to sing with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And so he phoned and he made it possible for me to sing the rehearsal with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And I have that and singing the national anthem in Cleveland for Nolan Ryan's last victory are probably the highlights of my singing career. The other bit was that Dave and I struck up such a good friendship that he invited me back the following year to speak on sports and religion, which is one of my areas of keen interest, and made it possible for me to offer the invocation for the Cougars TCU Horned Frogs game there on the BYU campus, also allowing me to sing another rehearsal with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So
who
I
won that game? Did you your prayer on our behalf?
BYU
Thank
won.
Thank you very much. We need more.
Even post Lavelle, I think. let me, as conclusion, read the final words from Martin Marty's foreword to the volume. When I agreed to read the manuscript and write a foreword, I don't think that I anticipated the scope, detail, and depth of this one. Now I pass it along to other readers who will find that such scope, detail, and depth represent gifts to everyone who has interest in and concern for the other in religious thought. In our crowding and conflict-filled world, there are more reasons than ever to accept such gifts and work to develop them and pass the results of new thinking on to others. Those are the recommendations of Martin Murray. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the chance to be here. Have I got 10 minutes?
You got 15.
Is that what we're working on?
Yeah.
I come as the token BYU representative to this event today, and I appreciate the chance to be here with you. I wanted to just kind of talk about the process we went through with the chapter, and then share a couple of themes or ideas or reactions to the notions of liberation theology. I entered into this dialogue at Dave's invitation with Robert McAfee Brown, who is a freedom fighter, who is a radical brother, and I began from the outset to call him Brother Brown. Is that our Comrade Brown? We couldn't go that far. I guess I just had a great experience in reading his initial writing. I was out of the country when he came to campus, but it was a real privilege to read and write and have him read and respond, as was the case with all of us in this book. Unfortunately, he passed away before the book. He passed away in 2001. I did not realize that we started on this 10 years ago, so it's amazing history. This is an individual who got his bachelor's at Amherst, became a Presbyterian minister, was a chaplain in the Navy, went from that to be an anti-war protester, a Fulbright scholar, studied at Oxford, got his PhD at Columbia, and taught at several theological schools such as Union, the Graduate Theological Union, and Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, was a professor at Stanford, authored 29 books, and spent a great deal of his younger years fighting for civil rights, going to jail as a freedom writer down in the South, campaigned against the Vietnam War, and most importantly, in terms of this volume, was in a collaborator with and a colleague of some of the real founders, I suppose we'd call them, of liberation theology, like Leonardo Boff of Brazil and Gutierrez, the Peruvian priest, and a number of other radicals who condemned the rich, condemned the social structures of wealth and capitalism, and aligned their theology with the poor, with the marginalized, and saw the Bible as a book for the oppressed, and called for Christianity to speak out against misery and be aggressive about it and to be angry about it. So that's kind of the intro of my introduction of my relationship with Brother Brown. Now, on the other hand, who am I? I'm not a theologian. I'm not a philosopher. I'm a BYU activist, if you can have such a thing in a business school. You need to know, I was a seminary teacher when I was a young man, and taught institute, established the program at the University of Michigan. No religion degree, however. I took Book of Mormon at BYU. I got a D-. But fortunately was invited to become a part-time seminary teacher, 3 out of 5 courses a day, which qualified me for full-time benefits and health insurance and other important things in life. I got the D because I continually argued with my right-wing arch-conservative religion professor, who was a John Bircher. And he didn't really like my so-called radical views back then when I was an undergrad. So I, in contrast to some Mormons who are seen, and some who see the Mormon Church as this big right-wing conservative institution, I see Mormonism as a movement not only involved in the next world, but more importantly in this world, and in transforming the world and condemning the evils that the liberation theologians discuss, and to build a church that's one of doers, not hearers only. And so I'm interested in things as a Mormon, like finding the ways in which our theology is pro-labor. To what extent does the church have themes in its teachings, in our theology, about environmental stewardship, about feminism, about working toward justice, about being anti-war and pro-peace and anti-Dick Cheney and pro... No, I promised my wife I wouldn't get in there and do that. Okay, so... erase that. We'll delete that from the tape. But my major approach to this was to read the richness of Brother Brown's description of Gutierrez when he first met him. And he saw him in this dark room in Latin America with a dim light bulb. And he's standing by in front of a blackboard, and he's talking to the poor, to the peasants, about Christ and about the Bible. And in my mind, I could see, similarly, a short, heavyset guy named Brigham Young doing a similar, engaged in a similar process with poor converts and impoverished people and Native Americans, describing how they should band together to change the world. Let me grab my... So I was interested in areas of commonality between liberation theology themes and Mormonism. Not so much on the divergence, but on the convergent. And to see what do we have in our teachings, both in the scriptures of modern day and the Bible as well, along with the teachings of modern prophets and church leaders. And to see how our radical roots may be tied and may parallel in some way the teachings of Gutierrez and Leonardo Boff and Brother Brown. So I'm going to just describe a couple of themes here that I tried to identify, in which both seem to argue to me that the personal becomes the political. Neither of them hold a neutral view of the world. They are very similar in their rejection of corruption and greed. Neither of them focus on religion as metaphysics only, but they both call for practical change, for strategies, for repentance, for action. And they both seem to have elements of a faith, a notion of faith as a force for transforming society. So here's a handful of themes, and then I'll wrap it up. Brother Brown, Brother Gutierrez, etc., talk about liberation theology's need to get back to the Christian roots, get back to the origins, get back to the prophets of the Old Testament, like Micah, who argued the cause of the widows, and who, as with many others, condemned those in power, or Jesus and his apostles in the New Testament, who also tried to live a very practical way in which they had all things common, in which they rejected the world. They were to be in the world, but not of the world. And I see a lot of that going back to the origins of early Christianity in the Old Testament is very similar to the Mormon view, the LDS notion of restoration. It's not simply a matter of breaking off and starting our own system that's an alternative, but that the church and its theology ought to be restored as it was anciently. Liberation theology, another theme. Poverty is a scourge caused by the concentrations of wealth and political power in the hands of a few, of the rich, of the elites. LDS scripture, the world lieth in sin because of inequality and greed. While liberation theology condemns those in power and argues for the countering of the military juntas in Latin America and a more open society. We see similar notions in early Mormon theology. John Taylor going on his mission to the UK and seeing workers exploited and being shocked, along with Heber C. Kimball, at the darkness and the oppression and the exploitation of women and children in the mines and men in the factories, and the gap between those at the top of society in the UK and those at the bottom. And they said they'd never seen anything like that, and they knew it wasn't of God. Liberation theology seeks to address real-world issues of human suffering. Its scholars argue for a religion that would have a preferential option for the poor. How do you build a pro-poor theology? That was part of their goal, it seems to me. Not just in the next life, but in this life. Similarly with Mormonism, there's this notion of the temporal and the spiritual, that they're both critical. You have Joseph F. Smith teaching about his uncle, the prophet Joseph. He said the religion that cannot save its people in this life would never have the power to save them in the next. So we need to focus on the here and now. Liberation theology counters the traditional Christian notion that fate causes injustice and oppression. It's the hand you're dealt by God, and you just should accept your lot in life. And instead, liberation theology argues that suffering is man-made. It's political. We must act. We must work against it. We must change the system. I find a similar theme in that of Mormonism. That is a heavy emphasis in the Doctrine and Covenants on things temporal, things financial, things economic. Wilford Woodruff said 88 of the prophets' 112 revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants emphasize financial and economic matters. And he argued that we can't build Zion sitting on a hemlock slab singing the songs of Zion. We got to get out and work and labor and build Zion with hard work and unify our efforts to make it happen. Liberation theology draws on the Old Testament notions about caring for the poor as our primary concern, caring for the widows, caring for the orphans. The New Testament also talks about the church being framed and organized to strengthen those who suffer and to free the individual from oppression. Mormonism draws on those same biblical teachings, but adds more in terms of the Book of Mormon, with teachings of King Benjamin to succor the poor, admonitions of Alma to not turn away the needy, and the many thrusts throughout the Doctrine of Covenants about the importance of consecrating our riches, our wealth, our time, our energy, our capacities to the poor. Both condemn the problems. I know liberation theology does in large part, the contemporary problems of the growing gap between haves and have-nots, between the CEOs and the workers at the base of the pyramid, the industrial nations versus the third world, etc. And both Mormonism and liberation theology have great concerns about concentrations of wealth and power. Now, let me just do a little quiz here as I wrap up. How many of you have ever read the Mormon Church Proclamation on the Family? How many have that hanging in their homes? I'm the only one. Okay, so I'm sorry. How many have read or have hanging in their homes the Proclamation on the Economy? Congratulations. Way to us. What's that?
I've never heard of it.
I'm hearing you now. I'm seeing that. Here's the Mormon Proclamation on the Economy, an excerpt. One of the great evils with which our own nation is menaced at the present time is the tremendous growth of wealth in the hands of comparatively few individuals. The very liberties for which our fathers contended steadfastly and courageously which they bequeath to us as a priceless legacy, this notion of equality and democracy, etc., they are endangered by the monstrous power which this accumulation of wealth gives to a few individuals and a few powerful corporations. If this evil not be checked and taken, and steps not be taken to prevent the continued enormous growth of riches among the classes already rich and the increase of destitution and want among the poor, this nation is likely to be overtaken by disaster. For according to history, such a tendency among nations once powerful was the sure precursor of ruin. That was signed by Brigham Young and the Twelve in 1875. That was before CEO average pay jumped from 4-to-1 ratio, the highest paid being receiving four times the incomes of the lowest, to today's 452 times to one. Instead, we have a world that somehow has lost its way in terms of some of these notions of liberation theology. Liberation theology grew from Latin American disparity between rich and poor, oppression of military dictatorships and oppression of the indigenous people. It later spread to Africa and Asia as this new theology began to find a home among the poorer classes around the globe. And the main argument was that the church should speak out, push for change, empower the poor, create democratic political systems, speak out against war and violence. That's the guts of it. Mormonism is undergoing a transition from being a Utah church or a Western U.S. or even an American church or even North America and European church to now becoming a third world church. 20 years from now, 2 out of every 3 or 3 out of every 4 Latter-day Saints will be from the third world. And what I loved in Brother Brown's depiction of the key salient features of liberation theology is I see so much of that as the major challenges Mormonism is facing today as its demographics shift so dramatically. And I think we're beginning to see, and I try to write toward the end of this chapter, a bit about the church's response. Gordon B. Hinckley is, I call him, a prophet to the poor. The rise not just of the welfare system that came out of the Depression, but of humanitarian services in the 1980s and LDS charities in the 1990s and the Perpetual Education Fund in the year 2000. And my sense of it is the church is struggling with these issues, but there's ways we can address these problems and contradictions, and that we as Latter-day Saints have a lot to learn from our radical brothers and sisters. They've been forming these comunidades de base, these base communities, small groups studying the gospel on their own, taking care of one another, lifting one another, supporting one another. We see the same sort of thing starting to happen with Mormonism, where in some parts of the world now the church is experimenting with small family community groups where people in the same body will get together in one of the members' homes and they sing and they pray and they partake of the sacrament and they talk about how to survive and they talk about how to transform their society and how to live in the world and not be of the world without a bishop, without a congregation, without a chapel, without a state budget or anything else. We see these inner city service programs and missionaries being called, the employment centers. When I was in the Philippines, I met these members who organized a handful of rice program in their ward, in which to go into sacrament meeting and worship, you had to put a handful of rice in the barrel outside the chapel door as an offering to support your brothers and sisters, or bring a pair of used shoes, or something like that. I was in Kenya a couple weeks ago, and the saints there, when they break between meetings, they go out on the lawn of their church, and they engage in what they call merry-go-round, where everybody puts 10 shillings or 50 shillings or $5 or $2 into a pot, and then they distribute it to the person with the biggest crisis and the biggest need for that day. So we're seeing this kind of bottom-up theology percolating among Mormons as well as among liberationists, and organizing fast for the poor and so forth. So in conclusion, let me just say I think both Mormon theology and liberation theology have a great deal of integrated frameworks and concepts and teachings, and they both require some degree of praxis, that is thinking and doing, or doing and then thinking. And it's not enough just to worship on Sunday and hope that that will take care of the needs of the world. Thanks very much.
Okay, technically we got 10 minutes left, but since we didn't get started till 10 minutes later, I think we got 15 minutes left. So if you want to ask a question, come up here to the microphone. Come on, Randy. And ask your question.
I'd like a little dialogue between Gutierrez and Niebuhr here. Both seem to be interestingly oriented toward Christian realism. One seems to be accommodation to the complex nature of man and history. One seems to say, let's go for utopianism. Let's focus on this. And I'm not saying that there's a contradiction. I'm saying there might be a tension. Would you guys talk to each other about that for a moment, and how Niebuhr might respond to Gutierrez today, and how you think it might work?
You need to go to the mic so they can keep it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you said it. For Mormonism, we dumped Zion. You know, we dumped it.
Yeah.
Because it didn't accommodate the nature of man. That's what I'm, you know.
Well.
Dump it or delay it? Delay it.
Niebuhr started out as a socialist and a pacifist. He gave that up. He gave up pacifism because he thought that the threat from Nazism and later from the Soviet Union was too real and existential, that Christian pacifism wasn't the answer. He gave up socialism because he thought that that wasn't going to provide economic development. It just wasn't. It was a bad economics in a way. Though Niebuhr got much more conservative in his later writings. In the 30s, his writings displayed a real tension between love, which he called the impossible ideal, and justice, which he thought was the virtue necessary for the world. But he thought love played a role by forcing us to think about the end point. After World War II, he got much more conservative. And what he would have said, and I don't know what he would say to the current liberation theologians. You know, Dennis wrote a book trying to make an argument that he offered a corrective or a critique. In his later years, I think that critique would have gotten much, much tougher. Just hypothesizing from his later writings, he would have said, look, if you want to help the poor, develop the economy. And you won't do that by creating what economists will call the moral hazard of giving people a free lunch. Tell them to get to work, because that's the only way they'll develop. If you feed people without having them work for it, then you'll just have more people begging in the line. And, you know, Niebuhr got more conservative. I don't know where they would have gone that far, but I can predict that there are a lot of conservative theologians who will argue that point of view. They appear regularly in places like Crisis and First Things.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I think the criticism, one of the differences, or one of the criticisms that some Mormons would have, who might describe themselves as liberation theologians within the church, is that they would align with Niebuhr in terms of not creating the welfare state and not doing the handouts, but I think they would say, on the other hand, you can't just overthrow the system and do what they're, you know, my buddy in Brazil, Lula, the president, he's got this zero FOMI zero, no hunger program where they're handing out food. It's not going to solve the problems. We could give all the money that USAID has and that the World Bank has and that the UN has and the church has. We could give it all to the poor. It wouldn't fix the problem. They've got to somehow become empowered. And I think for many of the LDS faith who like the idea of liberation, it's a liberation theology that has some entrepreneurial thrust to it. So it's give them a micro loan, not a handout that they take and spend and there's nothing left, but a loan. But it's grassroots capitalism rather than top down, you know, Fortune 500 capitalism. And it's giving them tools and training and education so they can work their own way out of poverty, not just abandon them, not just ignore them, and not just give them these handouts. And so I suspect that's one difference among the many now, thousands of Mormon entrepreneurs that are involved in creating co-ops, worker-owned co-ops, and microfinance and microenterprise and education, etc., is they're trying to build a kind of framework of democratic participation and economic empowerment of the poor and help them move toward self-reliance. And whether Gutierrez would buy into that, I don't know.
Oh, can I just make one comment?
Sure.
Let me make one comment.
Mormons are fond of quoting James. Faith without works is dead. Now, Mormons somehow think that other Christians don't believe that. I don't know any serious Christian who doesn't believe that. It's just how you balance the two. But for probably 150 years, we ignored the middle part of that. And the example was, if you go and preach the gospel to somebody and convert them, and they're starving, and you go away, and they're still starving, you haven't preached the gospel to them.
And a point of convergence, perhaps, between Niebuhr and Gutierrez would be in the shift from pacifism that both ideally would embrace, and that is that violence is used as a last resort in protest against the economic structures of injustice.
My question is somewhat about the process of developing this, and it's primarily directed to the Mormon participants. Such a project obviously is dealing with the intersection between Mormon thought and non-Mormon Christian thought. I'm wondering to what extent you found that your Mormonism actually made your understanding of these other theologies different, and so how much of the interaction was differences in how you understood the theology that you're comparing to Mormonism as opposed to actually the comparison between the two themselves?
I was thinking when you first started answering your question you were going to get into the gossip, which is really rich, but thank you for keeping it theoretical. Okay. I wrote my dissertation on Sark, on the desire to be God. It came to me in priesthood meeting as I listened to people talking about becoming gods. So the way I did my studies, and I think it's the way a lot of Mormons do their studies, is they look for the one that is closest to what they already believe. And that process theology was that way for me. That when I liked process theology's critique of traditional theism. If you read Hartshorne, the idea that God is creates ex nihilo, who's omnipotent, you know, the idea that you end up worshiping power, You know, these things I found very inviting. Once again, I mean, you can't adopt anything whole hog. And so, you know, and you see it with Mormons who go to graduate school and study religion or philosophy all the time. The difficulty is, you know, you when you encounter these things, they're exciting, and so you either Mormonize them or you philosophize Mormonism. And that is always the, you know, temptation, and the and that's something you struggle with your whole life. What bothered me with process is the same thing. I think that Buddhism has been an inspiration to me in my studies, but I like attachment to the other person. And so, you know, the idea and process of that somehow my wife is going to be a spectacular idea, spectacular memory in the mind of God just isn't good enough.
Okay. Hey, rather than go further on this, give us 2 minutes of the gossip. Since I am a co-author,
okay,
I've been totally out of the loop. I went to grad school at Michigan with Dave Paulson.
Yeah.
But I'm hearing from all our colleagues that, that there's been all this bloodshed. And I'm saying I'm too far off in the Marriott School, or I'm disconnected. Turn off the machine.
I don't know how to turn off the machine.
We'll leave immediately.
Okay, the gossip. I'm going to tell the nice version of the gossip anyway. Because
oh.
I'm a Mormon and we're nice. Okay. At first, this was a continual joke between David Griffin and me. Every time he would see me, he would say, "Is this ever going to happen?" Because you know, we finished our dialogue back in 2000. The gossip is that first, and Richard can correct me if he, and Joe can correct me if I get this wrong, is at first this was to be a joint project between BYU and SUNY, State University of New York Press. SUNY got tired of waiting because BYU was kind of vetting, especially the Mormon responses, for at least some of the people at BYU were vetting them for failures of what of some kind of perceived orthodoxy, which I'm not aware that we really have. And so SUNY just got tired and backed out. They tried some other publishers. These kind of things went on. Eventually, they finally settled on Mercer and BYU doing it. And the person at BYU who had been the kind of anchor, well, drag, I guess is the right term. He was fine with it, but then they submitted it to some committee they have down there at BYU, and they sent it to the wrong guy down there at BYU. There are a few of those, and he trashed it. So they sent it to two or three other people who were more sympathetic, but found a couple of passages objectionable. Since the people that had written those passages, one of them was dead, it wasn't likely that they were going to be changed, nor did anybody really want to change them. And so BYU backed out, which really thrilled a bunch of us that Mercer would be doing it by themselves. And I think that actually it's been good that that's happened that way, because the fact that it's not published with the imprimatur of BYU, although, you know, I think BYU is a wonderful place. I graduated from there. I taught there. I like all the people there. I think that, and I think people at BYU will say this too, that this will give the book more credibility, that it is published by a major university press that is not BYU. Does anybody want to add to that?
That's the more bloody version. No, you don't want to. Turn that down. We can unplug it. I'd do it. I'm going to go to the Church Correlation Committee. It's okay.
You don't want to. I won't say much. But I'll just flesh out some of the points that Jim made. The original plan was that it was going to go to SUNY and was going to be a joint venture between BYU and SUNY. There were people at the BYU, I'm not exactly sure who, though I know some of the names, and they will remain confidential, who had some problems with some of the Mormon respondents. They didn't have any problem with anything that the non-Mormons said. But they had problems.
You can't even excommunicate
educate those guys I know.
With some of the
since they're non-restoration.
With some of the things that we're saying. So then they tried to work with that. There was one idea that you were just going to scrap the Mormon respondents and have one person write a long introduction, which would be the kind of Mormon response to all these other things. And the person that they were thinking of having do that said, no, we as a group at BYU gave our word that this would be in a certain format, and that was just unacceptable. It was going to come out in the format they had given people their word to, or it wasn't going to come out at all. So then they went, then when it got back on track, they went to other publishers to see if they would be interested. One that, I mean, I know they went to
John Knox Westminster.
They went to John Knox Westminster, big time mainstream Protestant publisher, and they thought they would have that because Don McKim is their academic advisor, academic editor, and they begged off because they didn't think it would sell. They went to Illinois, and two things happened there. One is Liz Allred, who was doing that whole Mormon series in Illinois, is now no longer there doing that. And Illinois initially said, well, we might be interested in doing this. It takes 3 or 4 years to get to it. That kind of didn't set too well. They went to, I think they approached Abingdon in Nashville. That didn't pan out. And then the last thing they were going to do, and this is the part that I know pretty well, is BYU was just going to do it alone. It's better with Mercer, believe me. But I have many friends at the Y. I deeply respect what the BYU does. But I just didn't think that would look as good. So I was talking with Dave maybe a year ago, because they had it all ready to go, virtually camera ready, copy. And they had gone over it and over it. And they, and I said, Dave, you ought to try and get this co-published with another religious publisher. And we talked about the publishers they'd gone to, and I said, well, you know, there's Ashgate in England that might be a possibility. And there's Mercer, which is doing a bang-up job in religious studies and Christian theology. So I said, why don't you try Mercer? And make sure you present to them in your pitch the sales figures. Because do you know what a bestseller for a university press is? 1,500 copies. That's a bestseller. And just tell them that Blake Osler's volumes, published by a kind of local publisher without any kind of national reach, sold 5,000 copies. Because the one thing university press editors are interested in, besides academic quality, and in some cases in the place of academic quality, is whether it'll make money. Because then they can use the money they make from selling this book to subsidize something that's more of an acquired taste, shall we say. Look, if Mercer published a detailed book on modal ontological proofs for the existence of God, there are three people in this room who would buy it, and only one of them would read it. And it might be the best thing ever published on that topic. But see, if Mercer publishes this book and it sells 10,000, then they can take the profit from that. Because the one thing you got to remember is that university press editors, not their sub-editors or acquisitions editors who are interested in the content, the editor is answerable to the president. And his number one thing is, we didn't go in the red this year. And so that's, and so they went to Mercer, and then BYU backed out. They just, there were parts of it they just couldn't, that they ended up, and actually, people I know at the Y who were deeply involved in this project re-edited the two essays that were giving them the most, that were giving some people at the Y the most problem, to try and tone them down, and nothing worked. They just decided, we're just not going to be involved in this.
Did they unre-edit it?
Oh, yeah, it's not. It's exactly the way it was originally written. But they went through a very...
We lost one. Two respondent rejoinders that, for reasons unrelated to the earliest, to this whole process.
Well...
They had a change of mind, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
They did, but I don't think it was unrelated.
Okay, we're out of time.
Yes.
But I have to say just one thing before I let you go. That this book exists the way it is a real tribute to the integrity of David Paulson.
Yes, it is.